You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, July 25th, the feast day of St. James the Apostle. Apostle and martyr, St. James, pray for us. We'll talk about him here in just a minute. Also, later in the program, my two-part interview with Anne Maloney, Anne, who teaches philosophy at St. Catherine's University in St. Paul, Minnesota, with an excellent article that I wanted to have a conversation with her about from Crisis Magazine, Teaching the Faith in a Time of Crisis. And basically is that acknowledgement that, there are a lot of Catholic families who are discovering that, you know, so many of the things in the culture that are, let's say, erosive and corrosive of the Catholic moral worldview is not simply impacting those who are either nominal Catholics or those who are not, who don't practice the faith. It's affecting all of us, even the most devout of families, that, the combination of our own propensity toward darkness, as well as the all-pervasive and permeating culture in which we live, makes none of us immune. And what do we do? How do we respond when we realize the crisis is actually in the house? So we'll talk to her about that. I think you'll find it to be a helpful conversation. We'll also spin the Dollar Catechism wheel, and we'll talk a little bit more about Tim Kaine and Mike Pence, the two running mates in the election coming up, in which I'm voting none of the above, just as a reminder. 573-4BREAD-4, if you've got a comment or a question, or if you want to respond to our question of the day, as I said, after spending a weekend with my mother in beautiful South Carolina, got to enjoy some of her classic potato salad, which I always remember it from growing up. What is one food that you associate with your father and or your mother? 573-4BREAD-4, as I said, you can call or text or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Gotten a lot of good responses on this question on Facebook. There's, something about our parents' food sometimes that can be that comfort thing that when adulting gets hard, isn't that the new phrase, adulting? When adulting gets hard, it's nice to have one of those dishes that mama used to make. Take you back to your childhood just a little bit. I want to thank everybody for their prayers over these last couple of weeks for our son, who has been off at a boot camp of sorts and will continue. This is a thing called the Challenge Academy, sponsored by the National Guard. It's for 16 to 18-year-old young people who are considered to be at risk. We've had our son, who we love dearly, has had some challenges. We've had challenges as a family. And we have this opportunity that we really consider an answer to prayer and a gift from God. But it's a 22-week program, residential program, funded by the National Guard down in this one in eastern Kentucky, down in the mountains of Harlan, Kentucky. He's just finished up the 2 weeks of boot camp. I mean, it's legit, real stuff. It's drill sergeant in your face and so forth. 2 weeks of that, we had our first chance to talk to him via phone yesterday. Five-minute phone call, and he sounded like he was doing okay. He didn't beg us to come get him or anything. I said, Bruce, how'd it go? He said, oh, it went okay. I said, they yell at you? You get yelled at a lot? He said, no, only when you're not doing what you're supposed to do. I've tried to do good. I said, okay, son, there you go. So he even said the food was good, so he wasn't complaining. So please ask you continue to pray, and so we all pray for all of our children, of course. But he's got 20 weeks now of academic work, more military drills, of course, and adventure stuff. So really praying that this will be a transformative experience for our 16-year-old son. Speaking of family life, as I said, we'll talk to Anne Maloney a little bit about things that get into the house, into our homes, from the culture and from within, and how we can deal with it. We were talking a little bit last hour about St. James, the apostle and martyr, first apostle to be martyred, and how embarrassed, perhaps, if he had any insecurities left, now that he's in heaven, of course, in the glories of heaven, he can laugh about it, I'm sure. But the gospel reading today, not in any way blanching at pointing out the imperfections of the apostles. To me, that's one of the things that makes the scripture even more believable. It doesn't read like some sort of communist propaganda piece that exalts its heroes and just denigrates its opponents. I mean, the scriptures really from beginning to end are ruthless in their examination of and presentation of the flaws in their heroes. And in this passage, today's gospel, Matthew 20, the mother of James and John, the sons of Zebedee, approaching Jesus like a good Jewish mother. My boys are special. Wants them to have the privilege of sitting in his right and left hand. And Jesus said in reply, "You do not know what you're asking. Can you drink the chalice that I'm going to drink?" Only Jesus really understood what awaited him in Jerusalem and his passion. They said to him, "We can." He replied, "My chalice you will indeed drink." As we know, like we said, St. James, the first to die for the name of his Lord, the first apostle. "My chalice you will indeed drink, but to sit at my right and left hand, this is not mine to give, but is for those to whom it has been prepared for my Father." And then I like the detail it adds here. When the 10 heard this, they became indignant at the two brothers. Well, of course, human nature does not change. Circumstances change. That's why this is one of those passages I point to when people say they don't like politics in the church. It just really turns me off from the church when I see politics going on. Well, politics, which is simply the way we order ourselves as a community, which leads to competitiveness, which leads to ego, which leads to all those sorts of things. If you don't like politics in the church, it's been in the church from the beginning, from the original 12. They were jostling for position and for power. So toughen up, buttercup. It is part of the human experience. You don't want politics? Then let's get rid of people. That'll take care of that. Anyway, but the first reading, just when you think maybe the gospel reading is a little unfair to St. James, you read the gospel reading, the first reading, and maybe you recognize that reading's for our benefit, which St. James would want. I mean, if he's a saint, which we believe he is, he's in the presence of a God, he's enjoying the beatific vision, he's been made perfect in love, then his concern is not for his reputation. His concern is for our redemption and for our salvation. St. James, pray for us. And the first reading taken from St. Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, "Brothers and sisters, we hold this treasure in earthen vessels, that the surpassing power may be of God and not from us." Then he goes on to say, "We are afflicted in every way, but not constrained, perplexed, but not driven to despair." It's a beautiful passage. Check it out at usccb.org. Great place to go for the daily readings. But 2 Corinthians 4, "We hold this treasure in earthen vessels." In other words, the treasure is not in the vessel. The treasure is in that which is poured into the vessel. And so in seeing St. James' cracks and flaws, we understand that what God did in him, he can do in other cracked pots and vessels, which is us. I mean, that's our call. We're all called to sainthood. It doesn't mean we'll have a feast day in our honor, but it does mean that there will be no one in heaven who has not been made perfectly holy in love, and God will not do that with our cooperation. And if you think you're not the type, I'm just not a religious person, I'm just not that type, believe me, God works with sinners in making saints. It's all he has to work with. So anyway, good news indeed. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. Email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. If he could take James and John and make of them and Peter and all the rest, St. Augustine and many throughout the ages, he can do wonders in you. Anyway, we were talking about Tim Kaine a little bit, and his gymnastics, mental gymnastics, I guess, that he's been able to pull off on the abortion issue as someone raised Catholic who still practices his Catholic faith and yet sees himself as somehow able to relegate issues of reproduction and intimacy and relationships and contraception to the so-called personal realm, that they're moral decisions for individuals to make for themselves. And he says, I've taken a position quite common among Catholics. Unfortunately, he's right about that. I've got a personal feeling about abortion, but the right role for government is to let women make their own decisions. Now, Senator Kaine, listen, you're outside of this issue, your commitment to social justice is admirable. But to me, you lose tremendous credibility with a statement like this, and it's why I could never vote for you. The idea somehow that abortion is simply a personal decision, the humanity of the unborn child is not a religious concept, sir. The humanity of the unborn child is a scientific fact rooted in the fact that from the moment of its conception, it is a unique, this child is a unique human person. And so how do you make that delineation and say it's just a personal issue? At what point does that stop? The birth canal becomes the magic zone after which the child is protected, but not immediately before? I mean, the role of government is to protect the innocent, to protect the vulnerable. There is no one more vulnerable and voiceless than the unborn child. Yes, there are other things that government should do to try to facilitate a culture of life so that unborn may be more likely welcomed, but to say that protecting the unborn child is simply a personal issue, it's a cop-out, Senator. It's a cop-out. We'll be back with more. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show on this Monday the 25th. I had an opportunity last week to catch up with Ann Maloney. Ann teaches philosophy at St. Catherine's University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Her specialization includes philosophy of women, ethics, philosophy and literature, also philosophy of religion and existentialism. She has published articles in Crisis Magazine, Human Life Review, and the Journal of Pro-Life Feminism. I'll be talking with her about an article she wrote in Crisis Magazine, when the Teaching the Faith in a Time of Crisis, a very honest column and a very soul-searching, my conversation with Dr. Ann M. Maloney. Hello, Dr. Maloney.
Well, hello.
I really enjoyed your article in Crisis Magazine, Teaching the Faith in a Time of Crisis, as I was saying here before the interview. It brought a personal dimension to it, because we all look around and we see the erosion of many things in our cultures. And I think a lot of times we think of it happening somewhere out there. But as you pointed out, this is the kind of stuff that's happening inside our own families. And at the beginning of the article, you kind of walk through a personal experience of when you first started to realize that.
Yes. And, you know, really the article, I wrote the article out of just my heartbreak that I've always felt very safe in that in my nuclear family growing up and then in the family I've created with my husband and my three children, the world always was going crazy outside of us, and even in some ways the Catholic world. You know, I was raised in the 70s with the catechism of listening to Simon and Garfunkel tunes and sitting on pillows on the floor and making collages. But in my own family, it was like, well, that's goofy. And they gave me the truth. They gave me the church. And in the same way, my husband and I sent our children to, you know, the best Catholic school we could find, but they were exposed to a lot of, you know, kind of goofy stuff. And but they would come home and tell us at dinner, and we would chuckle about it, and they got the church from us. And that that kind of orthodox and solid Catholicism, no matter how crazy the world outside was, they always knew that their aunts and their uncles and their cousins and their grandparents, we were the church. You know, they were surrounded by strong, ardent, faithful Catholicism. And so I guess, you know, Flannery O'Connor once said that smugness is the great Catholic sin. And I always thought that was an amusing remark. But in the last year or so, as I say in the article, it's like the old story I used to hear at Girl Scout camp where the babysitter was calling the emergency operator that someone was going to come kill her, and the operator says the intruder is in the house. And that's the scary line. And I was just going for a walk the other night and thinking about some things that are happening in my own extended family now. And I thought, you know, well, good Lord, the intruder is in the house. This isn't the outside world anymore. This is their cousins. This is their, you know, their aunts, their uncles. And I can't anymore say, well, we are all in this place.
Right.
I grew up in a family. No one was divorced. I could go as far back in my family tree. I could reach out as far as I could see to aunts and uncles and cousins. No one was divorced. That's not the world my children are in. And it's worse than that. As I say in the article, my daughter is getting married and we're composing a guest list for the wedding. And our family policy has always been, if you're engaged, you're invited. If you're not engaged, step up, but don't expect to be invited, you know. Well, we realized that if we left everyone off the list who's living together in sin and not engaged, we would offend every branch of both families and some very close relatives of my daughter. And it's just like, well, here we are. Now what do we do? So when I was just feeling so depressed about that, I thought, well, there must be other Catholic families out there who feel like this. It all started when my daughter said, she has a very close friend, and she said, Mom, this family, they're the only outpost in their family, too. Their whole extended family has gone off the rails, and they're feeling under attack, too. And I said, well, this must be out there. I'm going to write about it. I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah,
I don't know what to do with my broken heart, but I'm going to write about it. Maybe that'll help me figure it out.
It's something that I've, you know, my full-time work, I work for for our local diocese here. I'm the director of family life. So I work with a lot of engaged couples. I've been doing it for about 11 years. And one of the things that I've noticed, you know, as for, let's say, premarital cohabitation or living together, it used to, you know, maybe there was a time in which it was sort of the poorly catechized, or it was the, you know, the inactive, the nominal Catholic young person who may, you know, move in with their girlfriend or boyfriend before marriage. Now it's the kids who are the mass attenders, who even in college, they're going to mass. They go to pro-life marches. They go to Washington, D.C. These sorts of cultural values begin to happen. And I love the line that you have here. You said the culture works like an odor-free gas that seeps in through every crack and window. It's sort of like a fish doesn't know it's wet. You know, we just live in the midst of this culture, and it does, and it has effect even on ourselves. I think we almost sometimes begin to sort of acquiesce or resign ourselves to it, even within our own families.
Oh, I think we do. And we feel very torn because we know the people in our family. We know that they are flawed like ourselves, but we love them dearly. And we don't want to be that person, you know, taking the stand and being the, you know, the judgy person or the hater. And I mean, when I was in college, I remember, and I've told this story in other contexts, but I went to a doctor for a checkup, and the doctor was going through my health history. I was actually in graduate school. I was 23 at the time. And he said, well, I see on your checklist here that you've marked that you are not sexually active. And I said, no, I'm a virgin. I was unmarried at the time. And he said, would you like a referral for counseling? Well, I came out and told my mother, and my mother, that was the last time I ever saw that doctor. And we laughed about that story for years because we still felt like the doctor had a screw loose. But now my daughter, who's engaged, her younger sister works at a Catholic preschool, a lovely Catholic preschool filled with lovely young women who are teaching these children and working for almost no pay out of the goodness of their hearts, pretty much, and doing wonderful work. But when my daughter announced that her sister was engaged, they all said, well, now is she finally going to move in with her fiancé? Like, my daughter was the weirdo. And that's what's happening to our daughters and sons. They are feeling like the weirdo if they're not moving in together. And the thing that's so galling, of course, is that they are cutting in half their chance of a successful marriage. No one is telling them that, but they can't hear it because they're not asking us, because they're not attracted to what we have. And that is what I located as the problem when I sat down to write my piece. They're not attracted to what we have, and that's what we have to work on, those of us who still believe that the Catholic Church is giving us the rules for joy. Not always the rules for pleasure, not always the rules for happiness, but the rules for joy. C.S. Lewis said, the serious business of heaven is joy. And, you know, we have to live those joyful lives so they'll want what we have, because right now, they don't. The culture, like you said, has seeped in and grabbed them, the intruders in the house.
We're here with Dr. Anne Maloney, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of St. Catherine in St. Paul, Minnesota, talking about her article in Crisis Magazine, Teaching the Faith in a Time of Crisis. What you say reminds me of, you know, what our Lord said in the Sermon on the Mount about, you know, you're the salt of the earth. If the salt loses its savor, when we look around and we see a culture that is in decay, without the presence of the salt, just like the preservative stops the meat from decaying, the question rather, if the culture is decaying, what's wrong with the salt?
Yes, and, you know, I think that is really the crux of the problem that we face right now, because, I mean, all good Catholic homes, I think, have a copy of the Catechism on its shelves, and the Catechism is a beautiful document, but not on the shelf, not if no one's picking it up to read it. Our lives have to be the Catechism for these children and these cousins and these nieces and nephews. And I have started looking, as now that I've been thinking about this, at my own marriage. Do my children, do my nieces and nephews see me constantly acting as if my husband is a man I'm in love with, a man who brings me joy, maybe not always pleasure, maybe sometimes he's very annoying, but always joy. And they will not want to do what we do until they want what we have. And I think that, I mean, one thing that Jesus made really clear is, I don't have any hands, arms, legs now that I'm, but you are my hands, you are my arms, you are my legs. We have to be walking catechisms of joy. And, you know, a good Catholic life is not always easy. But, I mean, a beautiful witness of this is one of my nieces, who is a lovely young woman, and she and her husband just had their first child 18 months ago. And when she had her ultrasound at 16 weeks, they found out the child didn't have any arms or legs. That baby is 18 months old now. He's a beautiful baby. They love him with all their hearts. Have they cried many tears? Yes. Have they been in terrible sorrow and anguish? Yes. But you know what? That boy is a joyful boy, and that is a joyful family. So it's not always that we're going to be able to say life is easy. And I can't tell you how many times I have said to people, Catholic church-going people, that Laura and John's baby was born without arms or legs, and their response is, didn't they have an ultrasound? And, you know, I just pause, and I just let them hear what they just said to me. And usually they just kind of move on to something else. But that's their first response. And my niece has to deal with that in her life. This is her son.
Right.
And so here they're living lives of joy. And no, it's not always easy, and it's not always pleasant. But I do believe that at the end of their lives, many people will be transformed by the witness they're giving of their joyful life. And, you know, so I guess that is just, I really emphasize, and I'm not saying we all have to act like, oh, you know, my life is so easy and fun and pleasant because I'm Catholic. But, you know, it's everything in my life is worthwhile. Everything in my life is good. Even the hard stuff is good because it's all transformed by the redemption of Christ. My kids and my nieces and nephews aren't going to stand still to hear me talk about things that involve words like redemption and Christ. They're going to look at me. And that's what I think we all have to keep working on and focusing on. We have to be those catechisms of joy.
We'll be back. We'll be back with more with Anne Maloney here on the other side of the break. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, the 25th of July, the feast day of St. James the Apostle and Martyr. In fact, the first among the apostles to die for the faith. Beautiful thing about being a Catholic is this understanding that we are surrounded by a cloud of witnesses, as it says in the letter to the Hebrews, who have gone before us, who continue to intercede for us, who serve not only as examples, but as our advocates. And St. James, who laid down his life, he went from a man obsessed, it seemed like, with power and influence to be at the right and the left hand, along with his brother John, as we see in today's gospel reading, to a man who was willing to drink the cup that our Lord drank, the chalice of suffering. And so, St. James, we ask for you to pray for us. We want to continue on in my conversation with Dr. Ann Maloney. Ann Maloney, who teaches philosophy at St. Catherine's University in St. Paul, Minnesota. An article that she wrote in Crisis Magazine, Teaching the Faith in a Time of Crisis, talking about how oftentimes the effects of the culture impact us all, and we have to acknowledge that. And the proper response is not despair or hand-wringing, but living a life and a witness of joy. So, more of my conversation with Dr. Ann Maloney of St. Catherine's
Maloney,
University.
Maloney, you make a point here, too, an experience that you had with a student who asked you to oversee a senior honors project.
Yes. Yes.
Because one of these, we have both a witness of our example, and sometimes we have to have the confidence that we ourselves believe and embrace this vision of the human person, and that we are confident that we see its beauty, not just as arbitrary rules, but as written into the very nature of who we are and what it is we desire. And so this young woman that you call Emma, mm-hmm. you had an experience with her in which you were able to share with her things that she had not considered before.
You know, and that's really, I'm glad you brought that example up, because it was important to me in the piece to point out that Emma, who had been raised in a Catholic home, went to all Catholic schools, you know, a good Catholic girl. But when she came to me to tell me that, you know, it was just obvious in what she was saying to me when she announced her engagement that she and her husband would be contracepting until they received their graduate degrees. And it was because, Emma, I knew that she already admired me and saw me as someone who was managing to have a good marriage, three children, and work as a professor of philosophy. She already admired me. She already wanted what I had. And it was out of that confidence that I said to her, you know, that's not something, you know, the church has some really good reasons for opposing artificial contraception. And she said, well, my mom, also, you know, church-going Catholic, said that that the church says I get to make up my own mind about that. And I said, well, that, you know, and I we started having some conversations about it, and I was able to, she was able to hear those things from me because she already was attracted to my life. And as a result of hearing those things from me, because she was smart, and now she felt, because she was smart, like she had, like somebody had run numbers on her. She was just like, why don't I know this? Why aren't I hearing this? A lot of people in my life don't know this. A lot of people in my life aren't hearing this. And that's when she decided to do her honors project to test, because she was a psychology and philosophy major, headed to a prestigious graduate school in psychology. She wanted to test perceived knowledge. What do people think they know about Catholicism versus actual knowledge? What do they actually know about Catholicism? So she, her sample population, both at two colleges in St. Paul, one of which was St. Kate's, took surveys in which first they took a test on their knowledge of the actual Catholic teaching on sexuality. And she got all of her questions out of theology of the body. It was great. And then she had them rate, you know, how well they thought they knew the sexual teaching. Well, more than 90% of these respondents who've been told all their lives, you're the best educated generation of Catholics ever, you're all going to college, you know so much. No, they don't. More than 90% of them rated themselves as very well-informed about Catholic sexual teaching. Less than 40% of them actually got higher than 45% on the test. They failed the test, but they thought they knew. Well, if you think you know something, you're not going to learn it because you already think you know it. And so what she was so struck by was the challenge. I'm very pleased to say that she has gone in. Now she is married, and she's now, oh, gosh, I think she might be in her last year in her graduate studies. But she does volunteer work at her parish in an office that is something like the Office of Family Life. And she has become involved in doing some of this work with engaged couples. You just see you plant one seed and look what comes as a result of it. But But she was like, this has to stop. People need to make choices and then follow their conscience, but they need to have an informed conscience. And I was like, yes. Thank you.
It's amazing. One of the things that I do as part of our marriage preparation here is we teach the theology of the body. We give them, rather than say, okay, here are the rules, we say, look, here's the whole vision of what marriage is, of what the human body means, of what sexuality means. And, we really help them see this, and as St. John Paul II saw it, as God's great yes to human love and human desire, and not God's great no. And I can't tell you the number of times that I've had couples, sometimes young couples, sometimes maybe couples who are entering another marriage, and they're in their 50s, they come up to me and they say, I've been a Catholic my whole life, and I never understood this. Why didn't someone tell me? If they'd have told me something of this, maybe I would have made different choices. And who knows, maybe they were hardened to it back then anyway. But obviously there is a thirst for this that we sometimes underestimate.
Yes. And I love the way you just said that, because the Catholicism is a religion of yes. And the yeses are so amazing. And the more we can put that out there and have people hear that and realize that, I mean, John Paul gave us so many wonderful tools to work with and really changed the whole orientation from here's what you can't do to here's what you get to do, and I'm just so pleased when I hear that offices of marriage and family life are focusing on that, because our archdiocese has, and it is, you don't win every battle, but you put seeds out there and you hope they come to fruition. And, every once in a while, God sends you a little. He says, here, this one, look. And then you say, okay, thank you. Well, I did that. Now I can live to fight another day.
We're here with Dr. Ann Maloney, who teaches at St. Catherine University in St. Paul, mm-hmm. Minnesota, Associate Professor of Philosophy. You're a PhD professor. You're obviously highly academically accomplished. I'm sure in your world, of course, there is the perception, and maybe not at St. Catherine's, but in some places, that that feminism, for example, and the Catholic faith are somehow not, that the Catholic teachings on human sexuality and mm-hmm. marriage and all these things are somehow hostile to the dignity of the woman. How do you overcome that?
I don't. That's a battle I fight every single day, and I have for going on 30 years now. And it's not just St. Kate's. I know it's everywhere. It might be a little bit more clearly defined at St. Kate's because it is a woman's college, but I've been struck my entire academic career at the willingness of people to let feminism be a lens to criticize Catholicism without at the same time letting Catholicism be a lens to criticize feminism. And, if only more feminist philosophers would be willing to see what John Paul has to offer. And so much of what John Paul is doing in his philosophy of the human person is coming out of Thomas Aquinas, which is then coming out of Aristotle. And, at a certain critical point in feminist philosophy, I don't want to get too technical here, but the feminist philosophers were going in a certain direction, and it was a very Descartes direction of, the body is bad and the soul is everything. And they said, well, this can't work. We need something that says the body's important, because clearly women's bodies are very important. Our bodies have a lot to say about the lives we're going to live and who we're going to be, and feminists saw that. And so they said, we have to get a philosopher who takes the body more seriously. And instead of going to Aristotle, they went to Karl Marx. And, John Paul saw that move, and he's sort of chasing after the feminists saying, stop, wait, halt, warning. They didn't hear him. And so now so much of contemporary academic feminism is thoroughly Marxist. And their reason was Marx takes embodiment very seriously. Yes, he does. But he forgets that human beings also have souls, and that's kind of important.
And so from one ditch to the other.
What I've been doing in my own academic work is trying to nudge feminist philosophers away from their complete infatuation with Karl Marx, who's alive and well only in universities. Those are the only people who still believe he has anything to say anymore. And trying to nudge them back toward Aristotle, because, of course, they can't hear anything. Once I say Karl Wojtyła or John Paul II, they're done listening. But if I say Aristotle, they kind of know they have to listen because he was a big guy, and then I can kind of nudge them forward, even maybe to Thomas Aquinas. But But that's one of the great failures of academic feminism, and it has been a failure with consequences that reach into abortion, contraception, sexuality, everything. It is the tragic flaw of academic feminism, and, you know, they haven't recovered from it yet, and I don't see that they will in my lifetime. But, you know, every day I try to empty the ocean with a teaspoon, and I can't focus on the fact that the ocean's still going to be there when I die. I have to focus on the fact that I have to carry this teaspoon right here, right now, over here, and put it down. So,
well, Dr. Maloney, kind of coming full circle then, it's as you make clear, that we can't respond with smugness as we see these cultural unraveling that's going on, as though it's not going to impact us. It's seeping in through our vents, through every part of our life, and even in our own sinfulness. At the same time, we can't go over to a sort of laziness and acquiescence. It's time for us, as you said, to get our teaspoon, to do what we can to shape and to form and to teach.
And to teach by living with joy.
Mm, absolutely. Well, thank you, Dr. Ann Maloney,
thank
for your
you.
Time with us today, and blessings to you and your summer
too.
There. And hopefully we can have you on again sometime.
I'd love that. Thank you so much.
Blessings. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So that my conversation with Dr. Ann Maloney, I think she makes a great point. You know, there really is no place for hand-wringing and despair. Certainly, we should give us a humility of understanding that, you know, there's nobody immune from the effects of the culture, and yet we have a responsibility, maybe even more so now, to live vibrant lives of joyful witness, to serve as an alternative to the prevailing view. We'll be back with more. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this July 25th on Breadbox Media, the feast day of St. James the Apostle. And Breadbox Media, of course, this digital enterprise where we seek through live streaming, through apps for your digital device, and through podcasting to proclaim and share the love of Jesus Christ, the truth of his reign, and to share as well the beauty and the richness of the faith he founded upon St. Peter and the Apostles. It is not an enterprise devoted simply to preaching to the choir. It is about accompanying all of us. We are all sinners in need of grace. We're all on a journey, and that's what Breadbox Media is all about. Breadbox, of course, a very thinly veiled reference to the source and summit of our faith, the Eucharist, by which we are nourished and strengthened, and which becomes for us the medicine of immortality. And if you want to know more, go to breadboxmedia.com. You could check out all our contributors from each corner of the country and from coast to coast, all different temperaments, topics, personalities, and all the rest, something for everybody at Breadbox Media. You want to especially check out our podcasts if you miss a program, or if you want to check them out, then you can go through Podbean, Google Play, or iTunes. Even subscribe or become a friend of your favorite show through a monthly contribution of support to receive exclusive online access to content just for friends of the show. Check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. Was talking earlier about Tim Kaine, the vice president pick for Hillary Clinton. The Democrats, of course, having their convention in Philadelphia this week, and Tim Kaine doing the classic Mario Cuomo dance in terms of on the abortion issue. It's a shame, really, honestly, because, I mean, I think Tim Kaine, much like Biden, a practicing Catholic who takes his faith seriously, and yet somehow, I would say, no, I certainly cannot form a judgment on another person's heart, but it appears to be as such that is a person like Tim Kaine, who used to identify himself as a pro-life Democrat, has in many ways kind of sold out. Hard to advance in the ranks of the Democratic Party if you are not going to play ball on the abortion issue. And the way he gets around it is that he's personally opposed. He does the same thing with the death penalty, too, by the way. He signed death warrants as the governor of Virginia. And it's something he's personally opposed to, but not something he feels right to impose on someone else. And as someone knowledgeable in the faith, educated by Jesuits, spent time on the mission field with Jesuits, advocates for social justice and other aspects, not hesitant to bring his faith to bear on other policy issues. It really seems to me like a moral gymnastics to get around that, and it's a shame. He certainly, his point is well taken, that there are aspects of Democratic policy that are perhaps more compassionate to the poor and therefore can help create more safety nets so that more babies will be allowed to be born. But to simply turn a blind eye to the state-sanctioned killing of unborn children is, we'll see how it's compatible. Now, I posted this Meet the Press interview that he had a couple weeks ago with Chuck Todd, and when she talks about this issue, posted a link to that interview on my Facebook page, and somebody wrote in response to it, Democratic Party is not compatible with our faith. Well, I mean, honestly, it really depends on the Democrat. I think you could say the same thing about the Republican Party, depending on the candidate. As I said, I can't vote for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. That's just me personally, but that's where I am on the issue. I never understand the antipathy that is there toward pro-life Democrats, authentic pro-life Democrats like a Rebecca Hamilton, who's been on the program many times, state politician from Oklahoma. Don't understand it, really. We need pro-life people on both sides. And yes, there are issues in which a practicing Catholic can take a Democratic point of view or Republican point of view, perhaps of economic emphasis or strategy and so forth, as long as they are not violating Catholic social teaching and principles. And so you could have a pro-life Democrat. There is no party. You're not going to find any party that is a perfect expression, I think, of Catholic social teaching. But I don't think you can carte blanche say that the Democratic Party is not compatible with our faith, because I do believe there are pro-life Democrats who are working for change within the party, and it is possible, in my opinion. Anyway, just like it's possible to be a Republican and not support Donald Trump, for example, as we saw that there are those who are not, like Governor John Kasich, who didn't show up at the convention. Speaking also of vice presidents, and I'm only going to be able to get into this a little bit today. I want to talk about it maybe more at length tomorrow. Mike Pence, the Indiana governor, who is now the running mate with Donald Trump. And I don't want to so much talk about politics with Mike Pence, but regarding faith. Not long after Pence's name was announced as Donald Trump's running mate, he described himself as an evangelical Catholic, and which piqued my interest just a little bit. I know my good friend Brantley Milligan, who came to the Catholic faith while he was a student at Wheaton College, which is in many ways the sort of Notre Dame of evangelicalism. It's where Billy Graham went to school. He and his wife, Krista, both coming to the Catholic faith, and he calls himself, in fact, he's got a blog, Young Evangelical and Catholic, because he believed, and I felt much the same way in my own journey to the Catholic Church, that becoming a Catholic was not a rejection of who he had been, nor was it of who I had been as an evangelical Christian, but rather a fulfillment, a deepening, and a more complete expression of it. Therefore, to be a Catholic didn't mean really I lost my evangelical sensibilities. They just find their fullness in the church. Maybe it's the sort of thing that George Weigel wrote about in his book, Evangelical Catholicism. So I was familiar with that term and wondered what Mike Pence meant by it. Well, he meant something completely different in some ways than I did. This article in the New York Times, Mike Pence's journey, Catholic Democrat to Evangelical Republican, talks about his journey from being raised as in a very devout Catholic family, one of six children, and he's the only Pence's sibling, Mike Pence, is, who no longer is part of the Catholic Church. While he was in college, evidently, in Hanover College, a small liberal arts college in Indiana near the banks of the Ohio, Mr. Pence, according to the New York Times piece, came to feel that something was missing from his spiritual life. The Catholicism of his youth, with its formality and rituals, had not given him the intimacy with God that he now found himself craving. He said, and I quote, this was in an interview with the Christian Broadcasting Network, I began to meet young women, men and women who talked about having a personal relationship with Jesus Christ that had not been a part of my experience. And he goes on to say, still, it was not easy for him to leave behind the church in which he'd been raised. And after graduation, he worked as a Catholic youth minister and even considered becoming a priest. He described himself for years as an evangelical Catholic. There we are again. He was part of a movement of people, a friend of Mr. Pence, who had grown up Catholic and still loved many things about the Catholic Church, but also really loved the concept of having a very personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And this is what I want to get into tomorrow, is this idea, really this, I think, false narrative that Catholics don't believe in a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And this is why Mike Pence's journey, even though it's certainly common, and we hear about this, we hear people say, you know, I grew up Catholic and I never heard the gospel, never heard I could have a relationship with Jesus. That's a problem, and I don't think it's something we need to simply wink at or dismiss, but it's also an unnecessary story. There is no more personal relationship with Jesus Christ than one could have in receiving the Eucharist, for example. And some of it's terminology, but some of it points to, I think, a glaring gap sometimes in our Catholic formation. And we'll talk about this maybe a little bit more tomorrow. Mike Pence's journey, like I said, a common one, but not a necessary one. We're about out of time, so let's spin up the Dollar Catechism wheel. We'll go to random.org, our random number generator, see what Providence has in store as we spin the wheel. Actually, we use our random number generator, random.org, to dial up a number between 1 and 2865, total number of paragraphs. 1922. This is in the section Life in Christ or the Moral Life. Huh. This is interesting. We just talked about the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, their compatibility with the faith. This is under a section on the common good and participation in social life. A little in brief paragraph at the end of this section. The diversity of political regimes is legitimate, provided they contribute to the good of the community. In other words, there is really no one necessarily political system that is the only means by which we pursue the good of the community, nor is there any one religious political party that exhausts the fullness of the Catholic vision. The diversity of political regimes is legitimate, provided they contribute to the good of the community. That is, I guess, the bellwether test of a political regime. Does it seek its own survival and power, or does it seek the good of the community? I think that's the standard we should hold our politicians too, and we ourselves in our involvement in the political process. Hope you have a great rest of your day. Look forward to talking to you by God's grace tomorrow. You've been listening to The Mike Allen Show, and this is Breadbox Media.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.